It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio once again, Maria Tomczyk, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And again, no job this week because he's on the tail end of a vacation.
Yes, a nice relaxing vacation, and he's just coming back off of that. He hasn't had a chance to look at the newspaper at all for 2 weeks, so he called in to me last night and begged off this morning, so it's just me this morning.
All right. Well, luckily you have been reading the newspaper.
Yes, I have.
Many of them.
Newspapers and articles online, et cetera.
Okay. Well, let's start out with some of the local things. There's a coming up Monday, a vote in the Seattle City Council.
Yes, we're going to once again talk briefly about the streetcar. I know some folks are probably a little tired of it, but it is moving through the Seattle City Council, and the Transportation Committee voted. They overturned the direction that they were headed in. They were headed in the direction of banning any use of city money for the streetcar. On Tuesday, they packed the council with some new members. I'm sure Jan Drago called up everybody she knew who would support her position and brought them in. And they voted 4-3 to allow use of city money. And the wording is vague. I believe it is the city is allowed to find new sources of funding to make up any shortfall that the developers and the folks who support the streetcar come up with when they're trying to put the money together to actually build the thing. So the council members that voted for it were Jan Drago, Gene Godden, David Della, and Tom Rasmussen. Now, the council members who voted against it were Nick Licata, Peter Steinbrück, and Richard Conlon, who's the chair of the Transportation Committee. And basically, Conlon said, look, folks, we really shouldn't be paying for building this, and this wording leaves open the ability for the city to actually pay to run the streetcar once it's been built. However, the city charter doesn't really allow the city to run any transportation system, so it's really kind of a moot point. But it would be bad if, for example, the streetcar were up and running and they suddenly needed funds to keep it going, and where would they go? They would probably go to the city asking for help. And then the city would be put in a position of, well, do we just let it fold after it's been built, or do we kick in the money to operate it? And that may actually occur. Now, that could also occur with the building of the streetcar, too. If they put together a financing package that covers all but a couple million of the funding to build it, they might go to the city and say, oh, we're 90% there. We just need these last couple of million dollars. Can we get it from you guys, please? Oh, pretty please. And all these lobbyists line up and start knocking on the mayor's door, and he puts pressure on the city council. And then before you know it, the city council's voted to kick in city money for it. And that vague wording, new sources of funding, could mean anything. It could mean anything from diverting property taxes to parking meter revenue and business license fees, developer fees, the sort of things that would ordinarily go into the city general fund at a time when the city is facing a projected $25 million budget shortfall, and there is a backlog of some $500 million worth of street improvements, sidewalk upgrades, and sidewalk repairs, and basic repairs to bridges in the city that needs to be done first. So, excuse me. For this to pass the city council, it has to go to a general council vote, which is probably going to happen next week. Is it scheduled already, Mike?
Yeah, it's happening Monday.
Happening on Monday of next week. And so, folks, if you wanna go and counter those voices of the pro-streetcar lobbyists, and there have been many of them, and they have put a lot of pressure on city council members, you should go to that meeting on Monday and speak out.
All right. Well, Conlon had brought up at I believe it was last Tuesday's meeting, saying, just as you had said, that the city doesn't actually have a authority to run a transportation system, yet the monorail is a unique system that it is allowed to be run by the city because of a vote.
Well, yes, but also it's going to be run by a private company. The city will oversee it, but it's a private company that will design, build, and then run the actual program. Now, that doesn't mean that the city won't be kicking in funds, but it will, because the citizens of the city passed not just one vote, but several votes in order to get this to actually happen.
And speaking of votes for the monorail.
Speaking of votes for the monorail recall, folks, have had a major setback in court. It was a superior court judge who told them this week, sorry, folks, but the monorail is an essential public facility, and hence it can't be recalled through a simple citizens' initiative. Which is that's a major setback for the monorail recall, folks. It means that their initiative would not go on the ballot this fall if that stands, although they are appealing. So we'll see where that turns out. Right now, the city council members are saying, well, we're going to put it on hold. We're not going to put it on the ballot just yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, and calling that a citizens' initiative, I mean, Martin Selig, didn't he cough up $173,000 to fund that?
He's coughed up, you know, 95% of the funding for the monorail recall initiative, and he's in line to cough up a whole lot more to keep the lawsuit going to try to get it back on the ballot. And it's interesting because, you know, people will say, well, oh, people who are opposed to the monorail will say, oh, it's really just developers who want it, et cetera, et cetera. And here you have one of the largest property owners in downtown who's trying to kill the thing. I think it's kind of interesting because this week I also noticed that the mayor is scrambling to get the old monorail up and running for a very interesting reason. It's the small businesses in Lower Queen Anne and the Seattle Center are suffering because the old monorail is not working. Attendance at the Seattle Center has dropped off dramatically. Now, there's a shuttle bus that the city has got going from downtown to that area, to Lower Queen Anne, to the Seattle Center, to pick up the passengers who used to ride on the monorail, but they're only picking up about 20% of the people who used to ride the monorail. So right now, there's this big scramble going on to find a couple $1 million to upgrade the old monorail to get it running and going so that it will keep those people going to that part of town. So I think folks really underestimate what's going to happen when the new monorail is in and up and running and able to take people to more than just the Seattle Center and South Queen Anne. Unfortunately, it's also running into some problems in the SoDo area around the stadiums. Isn't that right, Mike?
Yeah, I know somebody that's been attending some of those meetings, and it's sounding like there's a little scuffle between some of the groups that are, like the PSA that's representing the Seahawks Stadium.
The Stadium Authority.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they're not, apparently there's a national rule about that lines like a monorail or public transportation isn't supposed to come within 100 feet of stadiums.
Why is that?
Because of supposedly terrorist threats. That's the reason that they put out publicly, whether that's true or not.
That's insane.
Obviously.
That's insane.
So the current monorail, the proposal was to go within 7 feet of the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't go within 7 feet, the backup plan was to put it like over 100 feet away to meet that criteria. But there was talk of like having to elevate it 400 feet into the air or something like that. So, which again seems pretty darn high.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite the structure there.
That's going to affect the cost of it a lot, too.
It's going to affect that. But if they stick with my understanding is if they stick with the going within 7 feet of the stadium, then the requirement will be during games, they will not be allowed to run by the stadium. It'll have to stop prior to the stadium. People will disembark. I guess there'll be a station there, and then they'll, like, I guess, send it back in the other direction.
No.
So I guess West
insane.
Seattle just wouldn't get served during that period during the games.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah,
so.
No. I mean, this whole anti-terrorism thing has gone way too far, in my opinion. The fact that you can't run public transportation by the one facility that probably needs public transportation more than any other in the city is insane.
Well,
absolutely.
And that was how it was advertised, too, is that, you know, part of it was, and this will serve the stadiums, you know? I mean, that's, mm-hmm. you know, one of the...
Yeah, that's one of the main reasons, I'm sure, why a lot of people voted for it. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to get on the monorail and go to the game and not have to deal with parking and not have to deal with the huge amounts of traffic?
In addition, the other thing I'd heard about that was that if they move it 100 feet away, that the property that they would be going over would be Burlington Northern's property, and Burlington Northern doesn't sound like they want to like let anyone use that property because they have future plans for it.
Yeah.
So there's battles going there. You've got, you know.
Yeah, major property owners in that part of the neighborhood, and then these conflicting rules that just come out of the feds about what you can and cannot do because of the so-called terrorism threat. I think it's just absolutely insane.
So anyway, that apparently doesn't make the regular news, but luckily you can get
that
here.
But you can get that here.
That's right. So one of the things, jumping to national, international, one of the things we were going to cover last week and we ran out of time was Guantanamo, and the situation there continues to deteriorate.
Right. On June 28th, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, ruled that the Guantanamo detainees had to have access in federal courts to challenge their detention, that they could not be held without some kind of access to the federal courts. And so to respond to that, the U.S. government then said, well, we have to come up with something. We have to respond to this. So what they did is they said, okay, we'll set up these military review panels with three military officers who interview each detainee one at a time and then just decide whether or not to let him go. And they make this ruling. The ruling is they rule whether or not the person is a enemy combatant. And if they're an enemy combatant under the Supreme Court ruling, they can be detained indefinitely. If they're not an enemy combatant, they have to let them go. So what's been going on is starting July 30th, this military court, it's not even clear whether these three military officers who are reviewing these detainees are actually judges or lawyers even, just three military officers. These guys started up doing their reviews, and there have been 21 reviews so far. Now, the interesting thing about these is that the detainees in these reviews have no lawyers, so no one representing them. They have no access to the evidence against them, so they're not allowed to see what evidence the government has to support the fact that they're holding them in custody. The detainees have no ability to call witnesses on their own behalf. So far, of the 21 reviews, 11 of the detainees haven't even attended their own reviews. Now, the U.S. military says that this is because these guys have refused to attend, and that there's about 20% of the detainees who have refused all cooperation with their military captors. But we don't know if that's true, because these guys have no access to any outside counsel, no lawyers, no family members, nothing. So we don't know if the military is actually telling the truth about this or not. We just know that 11 detainees have not shown up for their reviews and have not been allowed to present any arguments or any evidence to support their being released. Journalists and the public have been barred from most of these. Journalists have been able to attend about 4 of the reviews. The first 4 detainees whose cases were heard were declared enemy combatants on Friday. That's yesterday. So, and of these 4, 2 of them didn't even attend their own reviews. And so the only evidence that the tribunal was allowed to hear was evidence from the government as to why they were holding these guys. So it's really obvious that these military reviews do not meet the standards that the U.S. Supreme Court would define as access to the federal courts. I think that's really, really clear. And it's I think it's just a railroad system. It's kind of a show trial set up so that we're doing the minimum under what we're required to do, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not even that. It's not even the minimum of what they're required to do. It's just sort of we have to do this for political reasons. It's really quite horrible.
So
it's interesting too, because the journalists who are attending these reviews say that the guys coming in to these reviews, it's pretty obvious that they're not linked in any way to Al-Qaeda. Most of them are Taliban members, or they're guys who were scooped up by the Taliban, given a gun and told that they have to fight or they'll be shot. You know, one guy was a driver for a Taliban official who was then drafted to become a cook. I mean, how is this guy going to tell you anything about Al-Qaeda? I don't know.
Tell you what they like to eat.
Yeah, but these are the kind of people who are being held at Guantanamo, guys who are just, you know,
cooks and drivers.
Cooks and drivers and, right. Yeah, and foot soldiers. And that's a lot of what the media has heard when they've interviewed intelligence officers about the level of information, the quality of information they're getting from the guys at Guantanamo. They're saying, gosh, you know, it looks like we just scooped up these foot soldiers. We didn't get anybody hardly of any value.
Well, that's... You could see why they don't want to let reporters in there to see what's going on.
Yeah, and at this point it's become an embarrassment. If they let them go, it'll become this horrible story that these guys will tell about having been held at Guantanamo for 3 years for nothing.
Well, which we've seen with other people who have been released.
Yeah, and there are people who have been released to other countries, to Britain and Australia and other places, who have said, you know, look, I was beaten and tortured and Terrible things happened to me there, and I just got scooped up, you know, for no reason at all. I wasn't even with the Taliban. You know, I was just trying to get out of whatever city because of the fighting, and I was scooped up, and I ended up spending 3 years in Guantanamo, you know. So it's insane.
All right. Anything else on that, or
no? Let's move on.
Okay, let's leap over to this week in Iraq then.
This week in Iraq.
Yeah, the major news out of Iraq this week is that the Shiite uprising has spread from the city of Najaf to about a dozen other cities in Iraq. Basra is the biggest news. Shiites there threatened to attack the southern oil pipeline and shut down the actual operation of the pipeline for a day and a half, possibly 2 days. And since then, it's been operating at about half capacity because of provincial council members. We're not just talking about Shiite militiamen who are following al-Sadr. We're talking about elected Shiite council members, provincial council members, city and town council members, and even a few Iraqi policemen who are on the side of the Shiite militia who are fighting in Najaf. And they're saying that there should not be tanks and bombs dropped on the holy city of Najaf. That's basically what's going on. Now,
they actually included last night on the news a clip I was surprised showing the police actually holding up signs.
Mm-hmm, protesting, saying you got to get out of there. Yeah, that's true. Now, something that we're not hearing on the news is that Shiite militants took control of the center of the city of Basra at various times this week. Now, it's kind of, they're fighting back and forth between British troops and the Shiite militiamen, but there have been times during this past week when Shiite militiamen have literally controlled the streets of Basra, the second largest city in the nation. So that's an interesting story in and of itself that you're not hearing anywhere. I think that's kind of strange. Now, in Baghdad, they're having almost daily shelling of the Green Zone, which is the security zone where the U.S. Embassy is and where a lot of the facilities for the Iraqi government are. That Green Zone, supposed to be a safe area, has been shelled with mortars and rockets, etc., from insurgents of, who knows, either Shiites or Sunnis at this point, on an almost daily basis. In addition, there have been daily battles on the outskirts of Sadr City, that enormous Shiite neighborhood that has about 2.5 million people in it. It's still pretty much a no-go area for U.S. troops. And in addition, other Shiite neighborhoods in Baghdad have also seen their share of protests this week because of the attack on the city of Najaf. Now, fighting and protests have happened in almost a dozen other places, including Kirna, Amara, Bakuba, Kut, Nazariya, Kufa, Diwaniya, Samara, Fallujah, Al-Hai, and of course the major battle going on in the city of Najaf. And often these attacks, the fighting is spurred on with the support of town and provincial councils and the local police. I want to make that really clear. Now, the people who have been killed, the U.S. military comes out with these fantastic numbers of, oh, today we killed 300 militia members, you know, today we killed 150, etc. However, when reporters go and interview the head of the nearby hospital, and they go and they look at who's been wounded and the bodies that have been brought in, what they're finding is that the bulk of the dead and the wounded are civilians, of course. Now, for example, in the city of Kut, where U.S. planes, now, we really have to understand the level of fighting, not just in Najaf, but in these other small towns. U.S. planes did a 2-hour bombing run over the city of Kut in order to drive back militias from seizing Iraqi police stations there. Now, the figure of the dead was 84 people killed and 170 wounded, and when reporters went to the hospital, they found that the bulk of them were civilians. So this is what the U.S. military is doing right now in southern Iraq to our allies. The Shiites were the people who supposedly were our allies when we invaded to get rid of Saddam, and now we have U.S. airplanes bombing their cities, taking out whole neighborhoods. And when you look at the city of Najaf, that's what's going on. The whole center market, the whole central market area of the city has been completely flattened. And that's U.S. warplanes dropping bombs on the center of the city of Najaf. Now, at the same time, you have Iraqi people watching this on TV. You have the whole Arab world watching it on TV. And you see U.S. tanks, Humvees and troops going through and desecrating graves in Najaf because of the fighting in the large cemetery there that borders on the Imam Ali shrine. And you see them coming within a few hundred yards of the Imam Ali shrine and saying, "We're going to take him out. We're going to take him out." That's what people in the Arab world, all over the world, are seeing on their TV screens. And so we've had protests in Bahrain, in Lebanon, in Iran, and various other parts of the world too about what the U.S. is doing in the city of Najaf. Now, so it raises this question of why are we doing this? Well, for a couple of reasons. They have to take out al-Sadr. This is the thinking. Al-Sadr is the main guy who is delegitimizing the Iraqi government right now, the appointed Iraqi government right now, because he refuses to participate in the upcoming selection for the Supreme Council. He's saying it's not democratic, so we're not going to participate. They have to take him out because he has so much support among the middle to lower class Shiite community. They have to take him out. And they cannot bear to have the Shiite regions of the country go the same way that the Sunni regions have gone, autonomously controlled cities that don't fall under the control of the central Iraqi government. It's like they're learning from the it's like the U.S. military is learning from the Afghanistan experience. You cannot have a country where you only control the capital city. You have to control these other key cities, and this is another reason why they have to take Najaf, is because they can't let these cities like Fallujah and Najaf and Bakuba and Ramadi, etc., fall outside of the control of the central government. So it's really a desperate act to try to keep the appointed government going. Now, on that same topic, the appointed government is going to be conducting a vote on Sunday, or they're going to be starting the process of selecting delegates to sit on the Supreme Council. Now, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. It was a huge 1,000-member conference of delegates, supposedly from all over Iraq, who were supposed to have been democratically chosen or elected, or in some fashion a democratic process through this screwed-up caucus system, to send 1,000 delegates to Baghdad to select a 100-member council that's supposed to advise Ayad Alawi's government. They would have the power to overrule anything that he had passed, and they would write a budget and get everything set up and ready for elections in January. However, there's a question now with all the violence going on, not just in the Sunni triangle, but now all throughout southern Iraq, as to whether or not the delegates can even make it to Baghdad, much less whether or not it's going to be a real democratic process. And they still don't even know how and what kind of system they're going to use to choose the 100 delegates. And then there's going to be a lot of fighting because the five main exile groups have set aside 20 of the 100 seats on the Supreme Council for their own people. So there's going to be a lot of fighting over that, I'm sure. And then finally, to wrap up this week in Iraq, I want to talk briefly about something that's going to be a big story, I think, in the next couple months, sometime in the next couple months. So I want you to hear it here first. U.S. supply lines are being seriously threatened in the country of Iraq. Hasn't become a big story yet, but it will be. In addition to Turkish truckers, who last week declared that they were going to stop hauling goods into Iraq because of the kidnapping and killing of Turkish truckers, Jordanian truckers are also being killed at an enormous rate. At least 100 have died in the past year, just from not from necessarily being kidnapped, but because their goods are being stolen. And I'm sure some of it's going to the black market, and a lot of it's going to supply the guerrillas as well. In addition, Lebanese transports into Iraq have dropped by 70% in the past few months because of all the violence in Iraq and because of attacks on the road from Lebanon into Iraq. Now, many of these folks ship their goods. Not all of them ship their goods to U.S. troops and U.S. bases, but many of them do, and that's going to be threatening U.S. supply lines. Now, of course, we could airlift supplies into Iraq, but there's only limited capacity at air bases in Iraq, particularly when the insurgents are firing mortars on an almost daily basis at the Baghdad International Airport and other U.S. bases, and they also are firing rockets at planes that take off and land. So that's going to be a real problem, the fact that U.S. supply lines are so badly threatened. We're going to hear about that, I'm sure, in the next couple months.
All right. Well, you had pointed out in the past that Ayad Alawi has a pretty questionable past.
Background himself.
And we're going to mention last week that President of Colombia appears to
also have a
share that
questionable
honor.
Background. Yes, there was a Defense Intelligence Agency report from 1991 that was declassified a couple of weeks ago as part of a Freedom of Information Act. And on that document, there was a list of 104 people that the Defense Intelligence Agency assumed were major figures, not, you know, just associated with, but were major figures in cocaine trafficking from the nation of Colombia. And on that list was Alvaro Uribe, the current president of Colombia. Now, Uribe likes to say that he had nothing to do with cocaine trafficking. You know, it was just something that was going on in his part of the country when he was a politician, you know. But I have to say, and anyone who has followed the cocaine story in Colombia knows that you do not become a politician in certain areas of Colombia if you are not connected to the cocaine cartels. And this document is just confirmation of what many, many people have suspected over the years. The document says that Uribe has links to Pablo Escobar, who is the head of the Medellin cartel, calls him a close personal friend of Escobar's, and he met him through the Ochoa family, who is deeply involved in cocaine trafficking. Now, this document came out at about the same time that the U.S. government has admitted that its plan Colombia, the sending, you know, millions and millions of dollars down to Colombia in order to spray coca crops and to fight the left-wing rebel groups down there, the FARC, that plan Colombia thing that was supposed to stop cocaine from flowing into the U.S. has been absolutely and completely ineffective, has had absolutely zero impact on the amount of cocaine that has hit U.S. streets. It's been exactly the same as it was before. And that should be no surprise, because the fact that this document has come out and confirmed that Alvaro Uribe has deep cocaine connections should tell us that it is not the FARC, the Colombian rebels, who are the major narco traffickers in that nation. It is folks associated with Alvaro Uribe, the rich landlorders, the right-wing paramilitary groups, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. And, of course, Colombia is in third place for receiving the most amount of American military support, I believe, of all countries.
Yes, and second as far as receiving foreign aid, I think.
Very quickly, Venezuela having a big election this weekend.
Yes, in addition to the conference going on in Iraq, there is a big vote this Sunday in Venezuela. It's a vote on a referendum to recall President Hugo Chavez. Now, the big news about this is that Chavez has survived a coup, and he's survived attempts to overthrow him. The folks who are against him are pretty obviously backed by the U.S. government, who has given them a lot of moral, if not financial and legal support, as well as training in how to do this whole process. The interesting thing is that this will have an incredible impact on oil prices and on the economy that I think the Bush administration did not foresee, even though they've been trying to stir up trouble in Venezuela. That this trouble, it doesn't really matter which direction the vote goes, it's going to be a problem for the Bush administration. I think that's very funny, because I think Bush is in trouble in a lot of ways. Seems like everything that they've done is going to go bad, no matter what they do. So we'll see on Sunday what happens. I think Hugo Chavez may survive, and he may not, but in any case, it's going to be a problem for our economy.
All right. Well, you got your bases.
So I
got
to wrap it up.
You got your bases covered there. Talking once again with Maria Tomchick, co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes around town, any place you find free periodicals, including public libraries. You can also find us online at www.eatthestate.org, and you can give us a call at 206-903-9461.